The following interview of Karen Button took place on Bainbridge Island, Washington, on Thursday, January 5, 2006. After the interview, stay tuned for contact information on Karen Button and the group she endorses, Doctors for Iraq.
This is Althea Paulson of BainbridgeBuzz.com, an online community web magazine on Bainbridge Island, Washington. I'm here with Karen Button, a freelance writer from Alaska who focuses on issues surrounding the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq. She reported from Istanbul this summer during hearings of the World Tribunal on Iraq and also from Jordan on the issue of Iraq's refugees. She's here on Bainbridge today to garner support for Doctors for Iraq Society and will be returning to the Middle East to deliver supplies and funds to that organization. Karen will be at Bainbridge High School today for the showings of Fallujah on Film, three documentaries about the U.S. invasion of Fallujah. She'll be on hand between showings for a question and answer session. Good afternoon, Karen.
Good afternoon.
I'd like to start by asking you a little bit about your background. How are you connected to these films?
I met a couple of these filmmakers earlier this past year, and I live in Alaska, as you mentioned. When the Siege of Fallujah anniversary came along, I wanted to do something to commemorate it. And I asked these filmmakers about showing their films at an event in Alaska. And it occurred to me that it would be a really great opportunity then to also have a fundraiser for Doctors for Iraq.
Well, so tell us a little bit about what you were doing before the war and what drew you to the Middle East and the Iraq issues.
I've long been involved with environmental justice and human rights issues, and I've also written quite a bit in the past. When the lead-up to the war was happening, I organized demonstrations in Alaska and wrote quite a bit about it. And I have continued to just write about Iraq and the issues surrounding the U.S. perspective on the reasons for going into Iraq and tracking the humanitarian effects of the war on Iraq.
And then I understand that led to you going to Jordan last summer, and you spent some time in Jordan. Can you tell us some of what you experienced there?
Right. Well, I went to Jordan primarily because I knew that a lot of Iraqis had left Iraq. Those who can't afford to have been leaving Iraq, and a lot of them have been ending up in Jordan. It's a very easy place for them to get to. It's also a place where it's a staging area for NGOs. It's a place where Iraqis who are continuing to do work in Iraq can come out and meet with Westerners and then take information or supplies back into Iraq. So it seemed like a natural place for me to go. I also knew that there was a refugee camp in close to the border of Iraq, and I wanted to visit there just to see what the situation was.
And what was the situation there?
It's pretty bleak. It's a four-hour drive from Amman. It's stuck in the middle of the desert. There's a small community called Ruwaishid that's close by. It's a truck stop, basically. It's about 10 miles from the camp. The United Nations High Commission on Refugees expected up to 10,000 people. They didn't really know how many would flee Iraq when the U.S.-led invasion happened. So they built this camp to accommodate a huge number of people. And right now there's about 1,500 people that are living there. So this camp is it's really something to come up to. I mean, it's completely surrounded in a wire fence. There's a guard shack there. And there's not a tree or a bush in sight. It's under relentless, scorching heat of the desert, and every afternoon there are the predictable winds that come up. So people are really in a very desperate situation there, and because the refugee camp is so small, they're terrified that they're going to be forgotten by the world.
Well, what types of services or aid organizations are helping out there?
There is a Jordanian group called the Jordanian Hashemite Charity Foundation. The UNHCR, United High Commission on Refugees, is providing some assistance, and then CARE International is providing some assistance. But it's pretty minimal, I'd say. It's actually quite minimal. Right before I got there, two weeks actually prior to when I got there, a number of the refugees, almost half of the community, had just arrived there. They had been stuck for 2 years in what they called no man's land that was in between Iraq and Jordan. And this despite the Jordanian government promising that anybody that was fleeing Iraq would be welcomed into their country and could stay at this refugee camp. About 2 months, 3 months into the war, they changed their mind, they closed their border, and these people were stuck in between these two countries. It was a dismal security situation. When I talked to UNHCR representatives, they said it was very difficult to get to the community, you know, because of security risks to them. So there were a number of people that were really embittered about that, that were at the camp. One man that I spoke with, his daughter died because of a lack of, you know, just really fundamental medical care. So when people got to this camp, they were at least happy that they had some sort of security, I guess, if you will. But the security has a double edge to it, which is that they really can't go anywhere. They're allowed to leave with permission to go into short shopping excursions into the nearby community, but that's really it.
Well, what is the long-term plan? Does anybody have an idea of what's going to become of these people?
Well, not really. The majority of the people there, interestingly, are actually Kurdish Iranians. And they, most of them, fled from Khomeini's regime during the 1980s. They ended up in Iraq. It was during the Iraq-Iran war, and they felt that they would be safer in Iraq. When they arrived in Iraq, they told me that they didn't expect a welcome necessarily from Saddam Hussein, but that they were actually quite fearful for their lives. Fortunately, UNHCR found them, and the ICRC, the International Committee on the Red Cross, and they were able to establish a camp. So they've been living for 20, 25 years in this camp. So anybody that's under the age of 25 years old doesn't know what it's like to be anything other than a refugee. And that's what they're mostly afraid of. When the Americans came into Iraq, one of the places that they started immediately firing upon was Ramadi. And their camp, Al-Tash camp, was just outside of Ramadi. So very quickly the security situation deteriorated. And those who were resentful of the Kurds being there started harassing them, and most of them fled. And the majority of them then fled into Jordan. What was interesting is they're all sitting waiting for UNHCR to resettle them somewhere. The majority of them, when I asked them about their status, would pull out either, some of them had a very small plastic encased letter from the UNHCR. Some of them had a very tattered, you know, it had been folded and unfolded many, many times, and they would unfold this letter with pride. And some of them, you know, had it tucked in between pages so that it was very pristine looking. But the majority of them, you know, had these letters from UNHCR that were dated, you know, 10 years prior, saying, we've received your application, we will do our best to resettle you in a third country, but if you can't be resettled, you have no right to appeal. And that's basically where they're sitting.
In no man's land, it sounds like. Legal no man's land.
Legal no man's land, right. And then there are Palestinians that are in the camp, and there are some Iraqis. But the majority of the Iraqis, if they can afford to leave Iraq, then they're living in the cities, and the majority of them are living in Amman. And some of them are able to support themselves. Others that I met were living, you know, 10 to 15 in apartment buildings, selling things on the street, cigarettes, foodstuffs, and so forth, and then sending the money back home.
Well, we know that the Kurds in particular, but all of Iraq has been in bad shape for years and years, long before the U.S.-led coalition invasion of Iraq. I mean, I remember as far back as, 15, 20 years ago, even before the first Gulf War, they seem to have been at war for an awful long time. Is it significantly worse now, or is it just a different kind of bad situation?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I have not met one Iraqi that has said that it's a better situation now. I interviewed a number of Iraqis while I was in Jordan, and then, of course, met and interviewed a number of them when I was in Turkey. A huge number of Iraqis actually came out for the tribunal. So I have not met one Iraqi who thinks that it's a better situation now.
But it may not be any worse. It's just they're holding their own, and it's all bad.
Actually, every Iraqi that I met said it's worse.
Really?
Every single one of them. And even those who told me that they couldn't stand Saddam Hussein, they said that they preferred life under Saddam Hussein. Because they were safe, more or less. You know, Saddam was a dictator. He was a ruthless man. He was known to murder many people. I mean, you know, the mass graves speak to themselves on that. At the same time, people felt that they kind of knew where their parameters were. That's what I've been told. People sort of understood what they could do and what they couldn't do. And in that, there was a relative bubble of safety. Now it's completely unpredictable. Now, under Saddam Hussein, there was 30% unemployment, more or less. Now there's 70% unemployment. Now it's not safe for women to be out on the streets. Things that have never been heard of under Saddam Hussein's regime are now happening, like kidnappings, especially of women, because people are so desperate for money. The criminal gangs are kidnapping people that they think will bring in some money. There's not running water. There's sporadic electricity. Sanitation is really dismal. The hospital and healthcare situation is also another very dismal place. So there's not a sector in Iraqi life that hasn't been affected at this point under the U.S.-led coalition.
And, of course, the U.S. government likes to promote the improvement of, having elections and a fledgling Iraqi government. Are the citizens themselves that you met hopeful about that? Do they see that as an improvement in their lives, potentially?
The citizens that I met felt that there would be no way that there would be free elections. They felt that it would be, they felt like that there was no way possible that they could have free elections under occupation. And they also felt like if that's what it took to move forward, to get the occupation, to get the occupiers to leave their country, then they were all for it. But they didn't really have hopes for the elections themselves.
Turning now to the World Tribunal, you were in Istanbul, I understand, as well, covering the World Tribunal. First of all, I'd like you to explain a little bit about what that body is and what its intent was, what it was doing.
Sure. The World Tribunal on Iraq is patterned after the Russell Tribunal, which took place in 1967 during the Vietnam War. And that tribunal was set up mostly to have some type of a historical record of the war, of the atrocities, and so forth. And that's what happened with this tribunal. Very soon after Bush decided that he was going to invade Iraq, people worldwide realized that there needed to be some type of mechanism set up so that the war could be monitored. So even before the war officially started, international peace organizations were starting to look at how they could figure out a way in which to monitor, document, and record the, you know, just the war unfolding itself. And so the first tribunal was held not long after. I think it was about 4 months, maybe 5 months after the March 2003 start of the war. And the tribunal in Istanbul was called the culminating session. And it was there had been 20 plus, roughly, there were 20, 21 sessions prior. So this culminating session was set up in order to look at all of the different aspects of the former tribunals. All the former tribunals would specifically focus on certain issues. One was on healthcare, one was on human rights, one was on the use of weaponry, and so on and so forth. One was set up about media. So this session included all of those different topics. And that's what made this session, I think, particularly interesting, particularly intense, and particularly all-encompassing. The outcome of the tribunal was a verdict that the jury put forth. They had 10 points in their verdict. The three most salient points in my mind are, first, they found that the U.S. and the coalition governments invaded Iraq illegally. Second, they demanded that all of the coalitions remove themselves from Iraq so that Iraqis can restore their own democracy and move forward. And then third, they demanded that reparations be made, and that all institutions that had been set up, any legal documents, constitutions, orders, and so forth, be declared null and void that Iraqis themselves felt like weren't helpful. the tribunal itself is not, it was not a set up under any legal jurisdiction. Right now, the United States, as you and many of your listeners may know, hasn't signed on to any formal courts. The U.S., in fact, has done whatever they can to try and undermine some of the, like the International Criminal Court, where I think that some of these issues would actually be taken. So what people have realized internationally was that there would have to be some type of mechanism in place where the people, the citizens, would have to make some of these issues come forward. So it's really, it's a citizens' tribunal movement that's happening. And what's happened as a result of this is people are taking, citizens from different countries are taking this information and they're using it to move forward, to press their own governments to either remove themselves from the coalition, if they are a part of it, or to pressure the U.S. to get out of Iraq.
And what are U.S. citizens doing with this information?
U.S. citizens, I have to say that the interesting part about the tribunal is that it's really not very well known in the U.S. And so I think that U.S. citizens would be doing a lot more if they knew a lot more about it. While I was there, just on a side note, what was interesting is that media complicity was one of the topics that was covered. And in looking around at the media that was there, I counted probably 150 different media outlets, but there wasn't one, not one, U.S. outlet, major U.S. outlet. There were two small, very small, independent outlets. Alternative Radio was there, and so was Deep Dish, and that was it.
And you were reporting.
And I was reporting.
And you were reporting for what organization?
It's an organization in Alaska called Insurgent 49.
And is there a website that listeners could go to if they want more information or to read your reports?
Yeah, it's insurgent49.com.
Okay, all right. And so are you, what can American citizens do if they're listening and they want to either spread the word or start pressuring the U.S. government to take note of these findings and reports?
People can go to, there's a World Tribunal website that they can go to, www.worldtribunal.org, and they can sign up on that. They can endorse the tribunal movement, and then they can also get on an email distribution list and start connecting with one another across the country and across the globe to help further these issues.
What were the hardest moments for you personally when you were covering this tribunal?
For myself personally, it was listening to the individual testimonies from Iraqis and seeing the breadth of how their country has been affected. We heard reports on gender-based violence, on the destruction of ancient archaeological sites, military bases being placed on top of them. We heard reports, studies on children in Iraq who have leukemia rates that have, they're 20 times higher than they were prior to the 1991 Gulf War invasion. Collective punishment that was used, that has been used against Iraqis. Just, there were so many individual accounts. I mean, look, the tribunal was 3 days long, and there were 54 testimonies. It was overwhelming. It was overwhelming. And I was sitting next to an Iraqi friend of mine during the tribunal, and during the last half of the third day, she turned to me and she said, "This is what it feels like to be in Iraq. It's relentless, and you can't get away from it." And it was that statement, I think, is what made me really understand the gravity of what people are actually going through in Iraq.
So what's your opinion of the best exit strategy in Iraq now, now that we're in it, and it looks very close to civil war? We have had another very bloody day today. I think there is something like 90 people killed just today. Do you have a view about that? How do we get out now that we've made this mess?
Well, that's it's of course a tough question, and it probably would require looking into a crystal ball. But I do feel very strongly that the U.S. presence in Iraq is a lot of what's fueling the resistance. So with the U.S. leaving Iraq and really doing something constructive to help Iraqis rebuild their own country, I think that that's the best strategy. I hear a lot of criticism of we can't cut and run, that term I don't think is really useful. I think it's rhetoric and it's propaganda, because I think we do need to get out of Iraq as soon as possible, because our presence there is increasing and adding to the violence every day. What we do need to do, though, is to understand what our responsibility as U.S. citizens who have the it's our government that has made these actions. It's our government that has made Iraq the place that it is today. And so I think it's also really important that U.S. citizens and the U.S. government stand by Iraqis as they continue to create their own government. We need to have not a hand in it at all. And when I say that the U.S. needs to pull out of Iraq, I mean all the way out of Iraq. Right now, we have something like 162 military bases in Iraq. 14 of them are being made permanent, and we need to pull all military bases out of Iraq. There will never be peace in Iraq until the U.S. presence is actually gone, and they don't feel like that the U.S. is meddling in their government any longer.
I'd like to talk for a moment about Doctors for Iraq. Could you tell us a bit about that organization?
Sure. When I was in Jordan, I met a doctor who is one of the co-founders of Doctors for Iraq. And it was during interviews with him that I came to find out about the organization and then understand the really important work that they're doing in Iraq. It's an organization of about 200-250 medical care workers and doctors. And what they do is they go to communities that have been laid siege upon, and they help to provide medical care. Another thing that they do is they help to document any human rights abuses. They document the numbers of people that have, civilians that have been killed in any particular battle. And they just, they keep track of the health situation in Iraq.
Are these members all Iraqi doctors, or who is behind the organization? Who belongs to it?
Right. They're all Iraqis.
Is there any U.S. suspicion that this is a politically motivated organization, or is this more like the Red Cross that is, you know, neutral in the hostilities?
Right. I don't know. I actually haven't heard any criticism from the U.S.
I understand that this organization has called for an investigation into human rights abuses, both against the United States and against the Iraqi government. Can you tell us about that?
Right. Well, the Doctors for Iraq, in their documentation, have found that Iraqi forces are being just as brutal in their perspective as U.S. forces against Iraqi citizens. And there's a new report that will be coming out very soon about the use of torture in Iraqi prisons, Iraqi-run prisons. So they have been calling for an independent investigation. I received an email from one of the doctors yesterday, and he told me that he just came back from Europe, where he was speaking to European Parliament and to the Belgian Parliament about the use of illegal weapons in Fallujah, and then also indicating to them that they would be having a report on the Iraqi prisons, the Iraqi-run prisons. And so they were calling for an investigation by those governments into these abuses.
And when you're raising funds today, and presumably you have been for some time now, what are the funds being used for? Do you know at all, or is it just general expenses?
Right. Well, the funds are being used. There's three projects that they're currently working on. One is in Fallujah, as many people may know, the city is still pretty devastated. And one of the things that this doctor shared with me when I interviewed him is he had just come back from Fallujah, and he showed me some pictures of the water facility in Fallujah. The purification system was bombed, so they are getting water directly from the Euphrates River, and the waterborne illnesses have skyrocketed, as you might imagine. So one of their projects is to provide water purification system in Fallujah. Another one is to rehabilitate the hospital in Haditha. This was another situation where this doctor actually provided me with footage of the hospital in Haditha that was taken just a couple of days after a five-day siege on Haditha Hospital by U.S. and Iraqi forces in May. This happened in late May. And I'm sorry, this happened in early May, and the hospital had been pretty much destroyed. So they plan on rehabilitating Haditha Hospital. And then the third project that they're working on is a rehabilitation of a children's hospital in Basra.
And do you know about these calls for investigations? Have you heard anything about the response from any governments for these calls, or are they just pretty much being ignored?
I think that these calls for an investigation are not being heeded, of course, in this country, but the Doctors for Iraq have been invited to a number of European forums. The parliaments that I just mentioned, they were invited to speak at those gatherings, and they've also been invited to speak at the World Health Organization in Geneva about a month or two ago. This call for an investigation is quite new, so I don't know that there's been any formal response yet, but there's been quite a bit of interest from European governments on all of the issues that Doctors for Iraq has put forward thus far.
Karen Button went on to do two showings at an event sponsored by a couple Bainbridge High School groups, Conscious World and Amnesty International. The second of the three films in the series deserves special mention. Caught in the Crossfire, The Untold Story of Fallujah. It was filmed and co-directed by Americans and Iraqi. The Iraqi would risk personal safety should they reveal their identity. So in solidarity, the Americans who worked on the film requested that they too remain nameless. Caught in the Crossfire has been recommended by many, including Dar Jamail, who is one of the few unembedded independent journalists reporting from the hotspots in Iraq. Learn more about this film at conceptionmedia.net. That's www.conceptionmedia.net. conceptionmedia.net. Doctors for Iraq is the organization for which Karen Button is raising funds with her current tour. They have begun a website at doctorsforiraq.org. That's www.doctorsforiraq.org, doctorsforiraq.org. They're working under conditions that most of us can barely imagine, so please be patient. They hope to soon have a PayPal account and more content on their website. Check them out. In the meantime, if you would like to learn how you can help Doctors for Iraq, or if you'd just like to talk to Karen Button, you can email her directly at kbutton@insurgent49.com. That's kbutton@insurgent49.com. kbutton@insurgent49.com.